for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Jim Leach became the 9th chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities this summer. Before beginning his 4-year term, Mr. Leach served 30 years in Congress, representing southeastern Iowa. He's a moderate Republican, and he chaired the Banking and Financial Services Committee and founded the Congressional Humanities Caucus. Now he's embarking on a 50-state civility tour as part of a Bridging Cultures initiative. Jim Leach joins me in the studio. You are welcome as well. I look forward to hearing your questions and comments. You can join us by calling 800-433-8850, or you can send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us through Facebook and Twitter. Congressman Leach, how good to see you again.
Well, good to be back with you, Diane.
Thank you. You know, I am fascinated that you have decided to make a 50-state tour to talk about civility and incivility. Tell us why you've made that decision.
Well, in life, we sometimes think manners don't matter a lot. Actually, public manners do, and discordant manners can really stretch social cohesion. And that applies within a country. It applies outside the country. When one uses a rhetoric of division, the chances are things get magnified in awkward ways. We all had a parent who at one time or another might have said something like, sticks and stones break bones, but names never hurt. But in the adult kindergarten of life, names do hurt, and often quite a bit. If you call someone evil, for example, a country evil, maybe you'll get a counterreaction that's less than helpful. In American life, what is so awkward is some of the what I call ahistorical, meaning anti-historical comments that are being made. Public officials are being labeled communists and fascists. People are even using the word secession, which is the most socially radical conceptualization in modern times, because it reflects back on American history of what we consider to be settled questions. And I think Americans are going to have to come to grips with our own history as well as our own philosophy. I mean, for example, we lost 400,000 people in World War II defeating fascism. We've lost tens of thousands and spent many, many billions, in fact, over $1 trillion, holding communism at bay. So if you think a public official is a communist, or you think that person is a fascist, what does that imply that what you might do? And the social cohesion in America is being stretched to a rather extraordinary extent.
What do you think you can accomplish with a 50-state tour?
Well, I don't look for accomplishing an immense amount. I would like to help start a national dialogue. And all I can tell you is that not to address the issue would, from the perspective of a position in the humanities, which I am part of, an institution called the National Endowment on the Humanities, I think would be a dereliction of duty. And so from my perspective, It's a mandate that has to be addressed.
Has the society itself simply become more accustomed to a coarseness of language, a coarseness of behavior? I think most dramatically of a member of Congress shouting out when the President of the United States, President Barack Obama, was speaking, a member of Congress shouting out, liar.
Well, that was not a high moment. On the other hand, frankly, it's not as bad as other things being said. And in the public discourse, many tougher things are being set forth. Now, we have rules of the House and the Senate that are surprisingly pristine. And so to the degree that those rules come into play, it's particularly awkward. When you think about what's happened in American life, in some ways we're much more civil than we were in the 19th century. After all, we had a vice president of the United States shoot our greatest secretary of the Treasury, shoot him dead in a duel that might even involved one of the parties being duped, because the pistols, we now learn 2 centuries later, had been filed to a proverbial hair trigger, and possibly only one of the parties knew. And that would have been, at the time, considered a foul deed. But part of public manners were the legality in some states of dueling. And today, fortunately, we don't have that that circumstance.
We duel with words.
We duel with words. Now, sometimes words are not overly meaningful, and sometimes hyperbole is part of life. On the other hand, there are times when they are exceptionally meaningful. And one of the things in the 19th century, there is a great poet named Walt Whitman who argued that America had an athletic democracy. And I really love the metaphor. And by that, he meant a boisterous and active and vigorous circumstance. And frankly, we had some very irrational precepts in the 19th century. After all, much of America supported slavery. And so these are precepts that were pretty irrational. There was a huge anti-immigrant movement in the 19th century, as there is today. On the other hand, the athletic analogy that I like, if you think of sports today, you think of great figures. And sometimes these great figures make mistakes. We all know the news this week's about Tiger Woods. On the other hand, if you think of the great coaches, I mean, Joe Paterno, Kirk Ferentz, Vivian Stringer at Rutgers, these are great people that teach the kids to work as a team and to be competitive as the Dickens, but to respect the opponent. Mm. And there's no team around that we all follow, whether it be professional football or college, which I'm more enamored with than the pros, but I respect the pros. Everyone is taught to respect the people they compete against. And if you don't, you're going to get whopped. And if you're on a team, if you don't act like a team, you're not going to do well. And to me, that should be the model for politics. I mean, if we had this athletic analogy where people followed common rules and struggled vigorously but fairly, I think you'd have a much better society.
I have in front of me the December 7th issue of the Weekly Standard, in which Robert Nagel writes about the incivility epidemic. He talks about how the Supreme Court's defamation decision coarsened our public life. Would you agree with that premise?
I think he's taking a logical point and exaggerating it. The Supreme Court ruling he's talking about is a 1964 Supreme Court ruling called the Sullivan decision, which was Sullivan versus the New York Times. And in that decision, the Supreme Court took a stance that made it clear that it would, as a precedent, that it would be very difficult to hold people in public life accountable for slander. And so a public citizen can be a little bit more slanderous about someone in public life where they can't as much in private life. Having been in public life at an electoral level and now back in an executive level, I have found from time to time that this is a bit of an insensitive decision. But on the other hand, the reverse decision would also be awkward. And so like everything there's a pro and a con. And in this case, the court held that a public official in the precision of the case was a newspaper that might have published something that was a little imperfect could not be held accountable to the same degree a private citizen could be. I think it's probably good for society to have to bend over backwards to support free speech, although I'm reminded of my favorite anti-civil libertarian law in Great Britain is that the Queen cannot be photographed while eating. And in the United States, that would be considered something the Supreme Court would throw out. Of course, she could be photographed while eating. But I think that's kind of a mannerly thing to uphold, and so I have no objection to it.
Well, but it would seem that this civility crisis here at home may have spread abroad in terms of the way we behave, not only here in this country toward one another, but the way, in fact, countries begin to behave toward one another. And perhaps, as our discussion goes on this morning, you will join our conversation with your own thoughts, your own ideas for former Congressman Jim Leach. He is now director of the Department for Humanities. And if you've just joined us, Jim Leach is chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. He served in Congress for 30 years from the wonderful state of Iowa. He is about to embark on a 50-state civility tour, talking about the importance of manners, the importance of how speaking civilly to one another creates a certain atmosphere within our lives, within our communities, our states, and indeed our nation. Right now, Congressman Leach, we seem to be going through a particularly tough time in terms of the notion of civility. Why do you think that is?
Well, there are a whole assortment of issues. Some relate to the difficulty of the times. I mean, we're at war. We are in an economy in that is very stressful to very many Americans. Part relates to the change in technology, where there seems to be a competition for parts of public speaking that is change the nature of which news is presented, in which stations from time to time appeal to one constituency versus another. And then when they appeal, they seem to appeal in exaggerated ways. And then part relates to the nature of the political process. where we not only have heightened partisanship, but we have an oddity that is not reflected upon very much in American life. The history of this country is that we've had great distrust of the extremes, and as a country, we've tended towards the center. But in the political process, the most overlooked part of American democracy is the primary, where very small participation takes place. And with small participation comes control of the nominating process as well as the platform process. On the Republican side, quite an activist conservative dimension. On the Democratic side, a vigorous liberal dimension. And so both political parties, particularly for legislative offices, are tending to nominate people with a fairly firm position that is well outside the center. And so in legislative office today, the most underrepresented part of the American public is the great center. And one might even argue it is profoundly underrepresented. And in that circumstance, you have the parties kind of posited against each other. You also have a phenomenon that increasingly people are suggesting that issues are moral. Most issues in public life are judgmental. But to the degree issues are being described as moral, it implies that if one person has one side, the person on the other side is immoral. And there are conservative issues, obviously, that relate to things like abortion, where there is a tremendous moral dimension. There are liberal issues that relate to a sense that more money for any social program is moral, and to object to that program is immoral. And the fact of the matter is that there's a moral dimension on both sides of the abortion issue, and there's a judgmental issue on both sides of the spending issue, and that we should be very cautious of that. But the feelings within the parties have broken down, and we're structurally moving in a Europeanized dimension that is very different than American history. That is, historically in America, if you're elected to a legislature, whether you're the minority party or the majority party, you're all parties of governance. Today, minority parties are being viewed as parties of opposition. And the minority is an exclusive party. Majority is an exclusive party of government. Well, that puts a very different aspect of debating and acting. If the minority can never agree with the majority and vice versa, I mean, in this complicated society, it's inconceivable to me that a Democrat can't find some good ideas on the Republican side and that a Republican can't from now and again go with the Democrats because both sides can be right and many issues are different for individuals. I mean, when you have thousands of issues, no party's exclusively right 100% of the time. And so to have parties organize in legislative bodies that are exclusively party line is just not the American way.
Do you believe that thinking on your part had a role in your defeat for re-election? That is, that your constituents saw that you were representing the center, but in fact they had moved more either to the extreme left or the extreme right?
Well, that's quite possible. I mean, as I look at electoral defeat, and one, by the way, that I considered one of the happier days of my life to leave the Congress. But I'm confident that some of the bedrock Republicans were disappointed in my representation on some issues. Part of it is the nature of the party. I mean, when I entered public life, the great cleavage in the party, Republican Party, was between Barry Goldwater and Nelson Rockefeller, kind of urban republicanism versus individual rights Republican. Today, if you were alive, Barry Goldwater would be considered a radical liberal Republican. After all, he supported gay rights. He supported pro-choice perspectives, and he would not be considered part of the newer kind of social conservatism. Likewise, the Democratic Party has shifted somewhat in certain international positions as well as in some domestic. And so both parties have moved, and it's an awkward dimension to be able to represent the views of all the people.
But if it turned out to have been one of the happier days of your life to go down in defeat, why did you run?
Well, I felt an obligation to run in many ways and to attempt to reflect a perspective that was personal and I felt identified with a large segments of the American public. On the other hand, why I considered it a happy day and why I uttered this at the time of my concession speech was the fact that I was pleased to go out of office the way I wanted to go out of office, as standing for what I considered to be the right way of representing. By the same token, I also think that 30 years is a long time, and that there is something about citizen representation that sometimes longevity doesn't perfectly reflect.
Let me ask you about the National Endowment for the Humanities, because looking back, surely the agency itself has had a certain role in inflaming the culture wars that we saw in the 1980s and 90s, and perhaps even that lingers now.
Well, I want to make some distinctions. There are two great endowments in America. One is called the National Endowment of the Arts. The other is called the National Endowment of the Humanities. And let me make the distinction. The arts are all about creativity, supporting theater and dance and art of a pictorial nature. And then the humanities are all about perspective, history, literature, philosophy, for instance, and a lot of related disciplines. And so one is somewhat academic, that's the institution I head, and one is very much more creative. The endowments, both of them from time to time, have done things that are considered controversial. And we've had some strong leadership. Bill Bennett is a former chairman. Lynn Cheney is a former chairman. And we've had liberal chairman, Sheldon Hackney, and we have had a long history of active observations about political life. In my case, I feel that I'm in a position to take a perspective, but not an advocacy of a particular stand. Like the endowment, we don't suggest that healthcare is the right or the wrong thing. But people might ask, what is the history of healthcare? And that we can describe. It's bringing perspective to issues that is what the endowment is about, and perspective can be controversial. For example, sometimes history is more controversial than current events. And for much of American life, for example, in the early 20th century, the Civil War lived, even though the Civil War was half a century behind. We have to deal with history. We have to deal with the lessons of history. We also have to deal with we should deal with the revelations that literature can provide and the guidance that storytelling can suggest.
Back to manners and civility. How will you present this? How will you try to spur thinking about this issue as you travel the 50 states, and to whom will you be speaking?
Well, I'll speak with anyone who wants to come visit with me. But I will be speaking at universities and in town hall settings and in places where I'm invited to come and speak, and on radio shows, etc. The perspective I try to give is one of talking about history, talking about philosophy. What is the meaning of communism? What is the meaning of fascism? What are America's roles in dealing with these issues? What is the meaning of a civil war? And was it about secession? And do we as a country want to work together as a people? And then what is citizenship? And should citizens not want to respect each other? And should citizens not want to participate? I personally think, for instance, that American citizens ought to be much more active in the primary process. And I am very respectful of everyone that wants to participate. And I'm hopeful that those with the most vigorous conservative views play a role in the most liberal.
Former Congressman Jim Leach, he's chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. It's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Texarkana, Texas. Good morning, Charles. Go right ahead.
Yes, I'm Charles Everett Pace, and I'm a cultural anthropologist and a public humanities Chautauqua scholar. And I'm wondering if Chairman Leach has any interest in utilizing the considerable bridge-building skills that we've developed in the Chautauqua program for public diplomacy, which I've done abroad.
Well, I don't know your precise program, sir, but yes, I'd be very open to speaking with you. And I hope after this show, if you drop an email to me at jleach@neh.gov. I'd like to pursue that. There are many, many groups in America that do public diplomacy or cultural diplomacy in their way. We sometimes make a mistake to think that our government is the only element of American diplomacy, and that's not the case. It's every American citizen that travels abroad plays a role, whether they be in business, whether they be in the arts, whether they be in academia. We represent America when, as citizens, we travel or work. And likewise, I sometimes like to think that how we treat our own citizens has a great reflection on our foreign policy.
And Charles, that email address again, jleach@neh.gov. Thanks for calling. Now to Michael, who's in Bethesda, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Real quick, I think there's two things that add to the incivility. One is, when our politicians and people in the public realm, I don't want to use the word lie, that's too strong, but I guess it is lie to us or try to deceive, people react to that, and they probably react more strongly than they need to. So when liberals, you know, understate the amount of control they want to take over the economy, or when conservatives overstate the same thing, people, once they find out the facts, when they start, quote, reading the bill and things like that, and they find out, wait a minute, people aren't really telling us the truth, they react to that. Number two is, this is by no way a new thing. I'm old enough to have been very active back when Robert Bork was being vilified and called a racist and a bigot and a fascist and all of this type of stuff from the left at that time. And I think the, quote, concern that's out there now about the incivility is, you know, both sides, I understand it's a both sides problem, but quite often we so much hear about, oh, these, you know, the people at Tea Parties are so uncivil. When I started college, I was absolutely apolitical. I happened to have come from a rural very conservative background. I went to a liberal Northeastern college. I was ingrained how racist, bigoted, you know, all conservative ideas were. And it made me react many times in uncivil ways, saying, wait a minute, I'm not a racist because I don't believe that affirmative action works. I don't want poor people to die because I don't think there's the way to do it. And I think, you know, yes, I know conservatives are uncivil just as much as liberals are uncivil.
All right, Michael, I'm afraid we've got to take a short break here. If you'd like to stay on the line, former Congressman Jim Leach will respond to your comments when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Jeff Moldauer of the Texas Sheiks. For decades, he's been reinterpreting blues and jazz of the 20s and 30s. He'll perform songs from his new album. Join us.
Strange things are happening like never before. My baby told me I would have to go. I can't be good no more, once like I did before.
And if you've just joined us, just before the break, former Congressman Jim Leach of Iowa, who is now chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities, heard a caller from Bethesda, Maryland, Michael, make some points. And now, Congressman Leach, I'd like you to respond.
Well, first, let me just say that Michael is so correct. If a politician lies, that's very disheartening and very dispiriting. I found in my time in the Congress that I held in very high regard some liberals, some conservatives, some in the middle, and maybe lesser high regard some on the left, some on the right, and some in the middle. And so the key thing is to be straight and to be honest and to be... Say what you think and say it in a decent and credible way. My own view is very simple. It is great to be a conservative. It's great to be a moderate. It's great to be a liberal. It's not so great to hate. And when people get to the point of being hateful, whether they're in public life or out of public life, we have a problem in our society.
You talked earlier about the use of the word fascist. You have heard, I'm sure, many talk show hosts, including Rush Limbaugh, make pretty extreme statements about our president. Last week I heard Rush say something to the effect that the best thing that President Obama and Vice President Biden could do for our country would be to resign because of all of what Rush perceives as their failed policies. That kind of rhetoric, though it may be seen by some as entertainment on radio, has a long reach. And I wonder how you now, as head of the National Endowment for the Humanities, feel that we as citizens hearing those kinds of statements can play an individual role in trying to perhaps balance, to counter those kinds of extreme views?
Well, one of the difficulties in public life is one has to respect almost every perspective, but particularly one has to respect the constitutional process. And we have an elected president, and it's in all of our interests to hope that any administration succeeds. And we should work together to try to see that that happens. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean there isn't a big role for vigorous differentiations. And so how you balance that out is the challenge. I personally, like all presidents, will disagree with this president on some things. We'll agree on other things. When you think about leaving office in America involves a violation of law and involves the possibility of great moral umbrages. And this president is a very decent man. He's a former constitutional law professor, and he is expressing a view that not everyone will agree with on every issue. And that's to be expected, and that's to be respected, and if you disagree, disagree. But I think a call for him to step aside would not fit the times.
How much influence do you believe conservative radio talk and television talk programs and hosts are having on what you perceive as growing incivility in this country?
Well, there's a role, but it isn't just to the right. I mean, you have it at the left as well.
You have very few extreme left radio television commentators.
Well, one interpretation, Diane. To conservatives, it doesn't feel that way. And one has to be very careful of recognizing that other people have a little different perspective. Now, I might, as an individual, be closer to your view than an arch-conservative view. But there has become something new in America in some ways, although our precedents that there's a commercialization of views. That is, if you're seeking an audience, there becomes a commercial dimension to it. Now, in the 19th century, almost every town of almost any size had at least two newspapers, and one would be definitively the Liberal Party, one the Conservative. You'd had a Whig Party paper, and you'd have a Republican Party paper, Republicans in some being the current Democratic Party, and you'd have perspectives that were vigorous, to say the least.
On paper.
What is a little bit new is the enormous power and reach of America's communication systems, there becomes a reality to perspectives that are put forth that may or may not be a perfect reflection of the best judgment of the times. Back in the days of early television, you had three networks that were competing for the balanced middle, although many Americans didn't consider them in the middle. I mean, they considered them to the left of the center. But that is certainly a circumstance. And you have many things happening in our society, some disproportionately regional, but virtually everything that is in the American system, there's a little bit of it everywhere. And so there is, in our history, we've had a vigorous left at various times. We've had a vigorous right. At the moment, the conservative vigor is greater than the Democratic vigor, or the liberal vigor, I should say. In fact, the most interesting national surveys are of the American public with the question, do you consider yourself conservative or liberal or moderate? And the biggest segment is conservative, about 40, and the smallest segment is liberal, about 20. And so people of a vigorous conservative dimension are naturally being attracted to voices of conservatism, and then these voices sometimes are at the conservative side of conservatism. And so whether they're perfect reflections or not, they are being listened to with great attention.
Let's go to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Alberta. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was a former public school music teacher, and at my school we had a substitute teacher that was very much into manners, and she would take a class that could be a bit disruptive with the students. Substitute teacher, and turn this class around. It was amazing. I recommend and hope that you would also target young children, because it all begins with our children.
Well, that is extremely profound. And I will tell you, the oldest tract on manners in American history is a very small pamphlet written by a fellow named George Washington. It was done as a school exercise. And most of it, I think, was copied from some sort of manners book. By the same token, he had his own individual aspects in it. And it would have advice like, don't talk with meat in your mouth. But it would also have advice on never forget that moral compass in your heart. We have gone a long way from thinking manners is important, but manners are important. But because they reflect respect, it's respect for people who differ that is so
indeed
important in our society.
Alberta, I'm so glad you called. Let's go now to Jacksonville, Florida, and to Gail. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for letting me come on the show.
Surely.
I certainly am just, this is a huge part of my life, what you're discussing. I was the executive director of Character Counts here in Jacksonville, and now I do the training for a part that we have called Pursuing Victory with Honor, and we train all the coaches, the baseball and softball coaches that go out in the community. And it's just amazing. The problems that I hear, they're not so much with the athletes, athletics. The kids are great. It's the parents that are a huge problem. And while I agree with the caller before who said, yes, it starts with children, if it's not backed up at home, if it's not backed up with all the people that the children come in contact with, then it doesn't mean anything. We can all teach. We teach trustworthiness and fairness and care. I can go down the list. But, you know, again, if it's not something they see in their school or in their home, then it's kind of lost. And we are just like every other nonprofit. We struggle with funding for something that I think is critical. I would just like to get, the idea of how we could pursue this and make it appear to be a necessity in terms of funding as opposed to just something extra we can do. The money. And thank you so much, and I'll take my answer off the line.
Thanks, Gail.
Well, thank you. I think what you describe is a very real condition. It's not exactly new. My first employment in life, I was a 15 years old, and I was a summer umpire for baseball games for Little League in Pony Lake. And the kids were always fabulous, and the parents were quite vigorous. And in baseball,
I love the way you use vigorous, because it's a kind of a euphemism,
well,
I think.
It is. But I have so many images of parental quasi-misconduct. But in sports, there are so many close calls. And it's only recent that we're having reviews by the new high technology, and you can have other people review, and the calls can still be just as close. But in baseball, the old secret was that the closer the call, the more, using this word vigorous again, the more vigorous the umpire has to say safe or out,
yeah,
or strike or ball.
Right.
And it's a way of trying to leave no doubt when there actually is a lot of doubt on the table. But one has to learn to respect the rules and to recognize, I mean, as in basketball, umpires and referees make mistakes. And you hope to hold them at a minimum, and you hope that they make about as many for one team as for the other. But mistakes are part of life, and so a good coach teaches a kid, if you've made a perfect block of a shot, but you're called for a foul, you accept it.
But you've also got to, as Gail suggests, help the parents to understand that their behavior has a huge influence on the way those kids behave, accept the umpire's decisions. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to take a caller here who is in Huntington, New York. Good morning, Jeremy. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys. If it's possible, I'd like to ask two short questions. But if nothing else, I wanted to ask specifically about how Jim Leach feels about the growing anti-intellectualism in this country, both on the left and the right. You have religious fundamentalists, and you also have people just for political reasons discounting any kind of scientific research or any kind of academic thought for political gain.
Well, I think that is a true dilemma, anti-intellectualism, and this is something that's not new in our culture. In fact, we had a political party in the 19th century called the Know-Nothings, which was an anti-nativist. It was a anti-immigrant party and deeply anti-Catholic. We've had very irrational religious wars in our history. By the same token, the amount of knowledge has really grown exponentially, particularly in the scientific area. And when it comes to religion, we all have to learn to respect each other, and that means mainstream churches have to respect fundamentalist churches and vice versa. And there are some cleavages there. And sometimes from a fundamentalist perspective, the mainstream churches seem haughty. And then from a mainstream church synagogue perspective, sometimes fundamentalists seem extreme in their convictions.
As he talks about anti-intellectualism, one cannot help think about the whole global warming issue and how many people are so violently or vehemently, to use your word, opposed to what they hear in the way of scientific evidence.
Well, I think you have a fair point. The scientific evidence is one thing. What you do about it, though, can be something very different. And the dilemma for the world is, in my view, appears to be compellingly on the science's side. What you do about it, people can differ.
Jim Leach. He's chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. He will shortly embark on a 50-state tour to discuss with all of us what he sees as a rise in incivility. I congratulate you, Congressman Leach. I wish you all success. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.